supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
For Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
Welcome to Voices in the Family. I'm Mike and Scott. On today's show, we're listening to excerpts from a panel discussion on special education that Dr. Dan Gottlieb and I hosted here at WHYY.
In 1975, our federal government passed landmark legislation known as the Individual with Disabilities Education Act, also called IDEA, I-D-E-A. It extended access to free, quality education to individuals with disabilities. Well, fast forward some 35 years, and now we're educating 6 million children under that act with a wide variety of disabilities. During this hour, we'll examine some of the challenges facing children, parents, teachers, and school systems, and we'll look at the trends affecting education today.
Our guests are Dr. Herman Axelrod. He is the executive director of the Green Tree School in Philadelphia. This is an approved private school that serves children with special needs. Dr. Linda Grobman is the superintendent for the Radnor Township School District. She has a background in special education and worked in Philadelphia schools for nearly 30 years. And then we have Dr. Leslie Neighbors-Ola. She is a senior researcher at the Consortium for Policy Research in Education at Penn Graduate School of Education. And Leslie is also the mother of a 6-year-old son who needs special education services.
Linda, let's start with you.
Okay.
Early in your career, now we're talking about the early 70s before this landmark legislation, you were working with what was then called low-functioning, trainable, mentally retarded. Imagine using that language today. Tell us about the children who were in so-called special ed classes back then. What was it like?
They were very medically involved, physically involved, and very severely mentally retarded. We had students on feeding tubes. Much of my job was to have students respond to tactile stimulation, visual stimulation. We had students that couldn't sit up. And as a matter of fact, I had students that were so medically fragile, they required 24-hour nursing care.
You were working with a group of students who had very severe challenges. But back then, what about other kids, maybe kids who had what we would now call ADHD or dyslexia? What kind of classroom situation were they in?
Many of those students in Philadelphia, which was where I was working, were being educated in regular public schools. Oftentimes, back in the early 70s, those students would have been in classrooms, sadly, in the basement or down a hallway. But students with mild learning challenges would have been in the mainstream with the rest of the students.
And they probably wouldn't have been diagnosed. I mean, when did we even begin to learn about learning disabilities, what they were, let alone develop any sophistication with diagnosis?
I don't think I could quote you the year exactly, but I do know that starting in the 70s in Philadelphia, we were programming for students that had been diagnosed with having learning difficulties.
So, Leslie, let's turn to you. When did things begin to change?
Well, then the goal became, after IDEA in 1975, the goal became to have children put in the least restrictive environment. And so that would mean in schools and classrooms with typically developing children. And so then these children with special needs needed an individual education plan, which we call an IEP, that set out goals and measured their progress according to these goals.
So that's we call inclusion. That's mm-hmm. our. What was the thinking behind inclusion or the philosophy?
The philosophy is to give full access to the curriculum for all students. And you often hear the phrase free, appropriate public education, but you often don't hear the rest of the phrase that's in the law, which is the goal is further education, employment, and participation in life. And so that's really the goal, is to give full access to the curriculum for these end goals.
Leslie, how did school districts deal with this? This is a whole new world now. I can't imagine districts really being prepared for that.
No. And in fact, the research has shown that the districts haven't necessarily been prepared. And so what we're dealing with now, right now we're dealing with a lot of things. So we have several issues on the table now. One is that in the 1990s, we learned more and more about how the human brain works and how children develop and the importance of context. For example, the importance of the family. And so you might see this when we have meetings to develop these individual education plans, the parent is almost always involved. The parent or guardian should be involved, and the parent is considered an equal partner in the IEP team. What we're also, of course, dealing with now is the interaction between special education and No Child Left Behind. But what we're also moving toward now, I think we're moving from a position where we looked for procedural compliance. So, for example, is the child sitting in the classroom? Is the paperwork filled out? Is there someone called a special educator in the building or in the classroom? We're moving from that, and I would argue we need to move toward more of a focus on quality of education.
Dr. Herman Axelrod, let me turn to you. Who are the kids who come to your school, your specialized school?
There are certain children within the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania where the school districts cannot find an appropriate placement. They have exhausted all of their opportunities, and the children are failing, the school district is failing, and they seek an out-of-district placement, and the approved private schools, of which there's 30 in the state, educate 4,000 of these students in Pennsylvania, which sounds like a pretty big number, but when you consider there are more than 2 million students in Pennsylvania, and approximately 10% of them, or 200,000, are identified as special education from mild to severe. The approved private schools educate 4,000 of them, which is not very many.
So as a parent, could I call you and say, I would really like my child to come to your school?
I get those calls about 9 times a week, Mikan, but there's a process because the approved private schools are supported by the state and school district. We have a line item in the governor's budget, and the state pays 60%, the sending school district pays 40% of the respective school's tuition. The child has to be referred to the approved private school by the sending school district saying, we want you to consider this child for placement in your school. And by virtue of that letter, they're saying, we'll pick up the tab.
Speaking of the tab, what is the tab for a student to go to your school?
Do I have to tell you? They're very expensive, and the approved private schools would range from $35,000 to perhaps $80,000 for a day program, depending upon the severity of the disability and the kind of supports.
So the low end is $35,000. The state's picking up 60% of that, and school districts are picking up 40% of that. And I'm not aware of many school districts being flush with cash. So their political economic implications.
Yes. As a parent, my experience has been is that the last thing that districts will do is provide you a menu of possible options and ask you what you want. What they will do, in my experience and in the experience of other parents I've talked to, is start off by giving you a drop. And then if the drop doesn't work, you'll get 2 drops. And if that doesn't work, and what you really need is a cup. And so they start by giving you little bits, this is not the way the law is written. This is not the way it's supposed to work. So the law is written that the child must receive appropriate services irregardless and not take into account finances. However, it's hard to imagine that working in the real world. And so what happens is that parents really, really have to advocate for their children. And they have to put together a strong team of teachers, doctors, other support.
Leslie, you are a mother of a special needs child. And maybe for us to better understand the process of how you set up the education plan for them, walk us through, tell us about your son, and tell us about how you found out what to do as a parent.
I don't know that I know what to do as a parent. I mean, and I think most parents feel like they still always need to learn. So I like to think of it as everything I will need to know to advocate for my son, I will learn over the next, 50 years. But I need to know it now. And so the best way to describe my son is he's a lot of fun. He's incredibly enjoyable. He loves people. And he is like a typical two-year-old, only he's six. And so he's not entirely like a typical two-year-old because he only has about five words. And this was because of a medical condition that happened in the hospital after birth. And so we weren't sure we're not ever sure, but we didn't really have a clear picture of the extent of his disabilities until he was about three or four. And that's when going through these IEP meetings and the other early intervention meetings, we really needed to find other supports. And so we have a wonderful team of medical specialists at CHOP, and there was one in particular, a speech therapist, that really helped guide us along the way and let us know that we needed to be arguing more strongly. And I also accessed the Parents Involved Network of Pennsylvania, who helped advocate for us during the meetings.
They are actually with us today in the audience. We'll talk to them in a little bit. What's the education situation now your son is in, and how do you foresee the future in terms of his education?
He is currently in an approved private school, so he's in the Easter Seals program in Philadelphia, which has been wonderful for us. So he goes there, and it's a school, so it's great because he gets to participate in a school just like his normally developing sibling. And he goes from 9:30 in the morning to 2 in the afternoon, and then he has aftercare. As for the future, we aren't really certain.
Let me ask you, Dr. Axelrod, for a child like Imre, who would possibly come to a school like yours, what can you provide? What are the services? What does a typical day look like in your school?
We have a variety of therapies, movement, speech, occupational, and music therapy in a special music room. And music therapy is very different than going to music that we went to in school where you hear songs and sing songs, but picking up the subtleties of a child's behavior and working with that to draw out some other positive behaviors. We take them on trips, we give them breakfast, we give them lunch, and in that way, we help them socialize. One of the most important components of the program is speech.
What kind of goals do you have for these children? What's a typical goal, if I can use that word?
The typical overriding goal is to get the children through early intervention so they can go to a regular kindergarten class in the public schools. And we are successful with most of the children we get. Some of them have disabilities that are more severe and have to go into specialized classes. What we're seeing now of these 70 children who we have are approximately half of them who are already identified as autistic or have autistic symptoms, and that's a lifelong disability, and they need specialized kind of education throughout their careers.
You're listening to excerpts from a recent panel discussion on special education. Our guests were Dr. Herman Axelrod, Executive Director of the Green Tree School in Philadelphia, Dr. Linda Grobman, Superintendent of the Radnor Township School District, and Dr. Leslie Neighbors-Ola, Senior Researcher at the Consortium for Policy Research in Education at the Penn Graduate School of Education. We'll be back after a short break. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Lourdes Regional Rehabilitation Center, the only rehabilitation hospital in South Jersey located within an acute care hospital. A rehabilitation center can help transform limitations into possibilities. Lourdes has developed a brochure with information about the decision process and details on selecting a rehab center. This brochure is available at 1-888-LOURDES or online at lourdesnet.org.
Satan chanson qui nous ressemble.
On the next Fresh Air, the godfather of punk, Iggy Pop, like you've never heard him. His new album, Preliminaire, features standards like Autumn Leaves and How Insensitive, as well as an original song inspired by Louis Armstrong. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Mike and Scott. We're listening to excerpts from a recent panel discussion on special education that I hosted together with Dan Gottlieb. Our guests were Dr. Linda Grobman, she's the superintendent for the Radnor Township School District, Dr. Leslie Neighbors-Oler, she's a senior researcher at the Consortium for Policy Research in Education at the Penn Graduate School of Education, and her son Imre needs special education services. We were also joined by Dr. Herman Axelrod, executive director of the Green Tree School in Philadelphia. Let's go back to our discussion.
Linda, let's talk about your school and how inclusion works in a school district like yours. You're at Radnor. How many students do you have there who fall under the special ed label, and what does that look like?
In Radnor, we have approximately 17% of our students are receiving special education services. And I use the word services because the way that the law compels us to look at our special education students is not only is it a free appropriate public education, FAPE, but LRE in the least restrictive environment, which is the neighborhood school. And if you think about it, where would the child go to school had they not had a special education need? We have many of our classes in Radnor are inclusion classes. We have two teachers in a room, a regular education teacher and a teacher of special education that works with students, those with IEPs and those without IEPs. It really is the best of both worlds because you're able to meet the needs of students who are at risk prior to needing services. And what it also does is it aligns the students with special education so they can more fully embrace the regular ed curriculum.
I want to come back to this business of IEP and individualized mm-hmm. education programs. I speak to a lot of parents who consider that war of the worlds, those IEP meetings, because they really do have different agendas. And Leslie, I see the look on your face. You're ready to answer this. There really are different agendas, and this is a critical document for parents. This, in effect,
it's a
legal contract between the parent and the school. And, you know, we commented about parents need a cup and school districts give a drop. This is a critical issue. Mm-hmm.
If someday I write a book about this, chapter 3 or 4 will be called The IEP Meeting is Not a Parent-Teacher Conference, because I was very good in school, and my parents would come home and say, you know, we went to your parent-teacher conference and we said good things. And so I approached the first IEP meeting like that, and that is the last thing that a parent wants to do, because if your child can do all this, they're not going to get any services. And so as a parent, you need to be critical, appropriately critical, when they say, oh, you know, Imre could hang up his jacket. Well, I say yes, but only if somebody is holding his hand. And so he really needs more PT or more physical therapy or more occupational therapy. And so my husband and I, we've learned to prepare weeks in advance for the IEP. And now we, you know, now we feel that we have the supports, and it has become more collaborative for us. But there was a point where we definitely feel it was more confrontational.
As many people know, my grandson Sam is on the autism spectrum, and my daughter and son-in-law went through these struggles also. But one of the things she said that broke her heart was her preparation, and in the meeting, she had to emphasize and sometimes overemphasize what he can't do, his weaknesses. That's all she hammered away at. And she couldn't address his strengths for fear that he would lose services that he needs.
The beginning of the IEP meeting should be the present levels, so what the child can do now. And I find that I use that we use that time to talk about the progress he's made. But you're right, after that it should move to where the gap is between what my son can do and what his goals were, and the services, and the important part, the services he needs to help him reach those goals.
So let me ask you what this means for teachers. When I have a class of 25, 26 students, and maybe six of them have IEPs, do I have to know exactly what's in them and what I should teach or try to teach this child?
I think that's a really big issue, and I think that pre-service programs can do a better job of preparing teachers for the variation that they're going to see in a classroom, because it's not just in urban school districts that you see this variation. It's also in suburban school districts or rural school districts. And so if pre-service programs are at all giving teachers or letting teachers keep the idea that I'm going to have, you know, 20 kids ready on day one, all ready to start on page three, that is completely the wrong idea of what a teacher is and what a teacher needs to be. And so I think that pre-service programs can do their role. I think that information about special education needs to be included in different pre-service coursework. So not just one course on special ed, but if you have a course on assessment, you need to address special ed. If you have a course on English language learners. And so that needs to be brought into the curriculum for teachers, pre-service teachers.
So how much do teachers have to vary their curriculum then? If I'm teaching math and every kid in my class is 10 years old, but they may have totally different levels of where they are. So how does that affect how I teach them and how I plan to teach them?
Okay, that's a tough question. But what the special education classrooms do is group children according to abilities so that there can be a common lesson and then break up into smaller groups where there would be direct instruction continuing and other children following up on what was taught and other children doing independent work.
But it sounds very difficult to me.
But good teachers have been doing that all their life. So, in fact, our most excellent teachers have always been looking at the needs of the students in their classes. They have been grouping students. They have been accelerating and providing opportunities for students to go beyond the curriculum. They've given extra work for students who, in fact, need that extra work. The new law actually has teachers now capturing their response to intervention, or RTI. We are now looking at what worked, how can we do it better, and teachers are learning a lot on differentiating that instruction and collaborating.
And that's exactly where I'd like to go now. Let's take a look at the big picture and take a look at the research. We've got a lot of programs and a lot of definition of special needs. Let me turn to you, Leslie. What works? What doesn't work?
We know much more about what works for children with actually the low incidence disabilities. These are the more severe disabilities. So, for example, they would be blind children, children who are deaf or hard of hearing. So, for example, changes that have been made to the laws in the past, they now actually mandate that Braille and American Sign Language be considered when you're forming an IEP or individualized education plan. We give these children, and my son actually falls into this category, we give them summer school. It's called extended school year. And so we've paid a lot of attention, appropriately so, to these children with low incidence disabilities. The children we know now much less about the programs that work for children with milder learning disabilities, and I think the teacher makes all the difference. And so if you don't have the money to get high quality teachers or to support them, no program is going to work.
Do we have a sense, I want to press you on this, and there might not be an answer, for the higher incidence disabilities, do we have a sense of what works and what doesn't? And I'll ask the big picture that Mike and I have been talking about and preparing the show. Does inclusion work? And who does it work for? Do we know?
Inclusion can work. One of the approaches that has research behind it is explicit instruction and strategies. But again, that is highly mediated by the quality of the teacher and her attention to who needs what strategy. And so again, it all goes through the teacher. The teacher is just absolutely critical.
What do we know about graduation rates for, you mentioned the low incidence population, what do we know in terms of graduation rates for the high incidence population?
I can speak to Radnor, it was 100%. In Philadelphia, it was less than 50% of students with IEPs in the high incidence spectrum, not the low incidence spectrum, which is fairly aligned with the graduation rate in Philadelphia anyway. It's slightly lower than the general population.
And Herman, in your school, you want to gently move children toward inclusion, but as a special ed educator in a specialized school, what are your thoughts on inclusion?
I think it works in many instances, and in some, it can't work. There was a decision in Pennsylvania a couple years ago called the Gaskins decision, and Joe Gaskins' daughter was Down syndrome, mentally retarded, and he wanted her in an inclusion class. The district wanted her in a specialized class, and he fought, and he won, and the state law now says that every child has to be considered for inclusion. And they are, and many of them are in the class. The children who we have in the APSs, and again, it's such a small minority of the special ed students in the state, cannot do it, and I would defy school districts to be able to pull that off.
I wonder about research. What kind of researches are there out there, future trends? Where are we going? Where should we go with special ed? Leslie?
I should preface by saying that education research, like education, is underfunded. And so we are working in education research. We're working with approximately 1/100th of the budget of medical research. And so it should come as no surprise that we don't have some of the answers that you might find in medicine, although they, of course, don't have all the answers either. But I think what we need to do is education research and special education needs to go into the classroom and really look at this quality of education issue, because it's not just about placement, it's not just about procedural compliance, but what works for particular populations of students in classrooms.
Now, throughout the discussion, we've been hearing about the role of parents, and it sounds like this is a process that could really be exhausting to parents because you have to stay on top of it every step of the way. And in the audience, we have Becky Espanol. She is with the Parents Involved Network. And Becky, you help parents in our region get things like the individualized education plan together. You advocate for parents.
Yes, we do. We help children from 0 to 21. We get a lot of parents that come from Children's Hospital, from CHOP, referred by them because we have done workshops for their social workers so they will know where to send their parents when they give them the referral form with all the services that their child needs. We are there to support and advocate and inform the parents of their rights and their child's rights. We advocate one-to-one. We navigate with them the child welfare system throughout Philadelphia, plus Montgomery County and Delaware County, because we do have Parents Involved Network at those two other counties. And we are all peers. We are all parents of children who have children with challenges. We hate to use the word disabled because everybody has their own way of learning. Even significantly, the people that supposed to be normal. We all have a way of learning. So for us as children that are challenged, and we try to help the parent receive and understand the services and the systems.
Let me ask you, Becky, what are some of the frustrations that you hear about that parents mention to you?
Well, after the parents go through the honeymoon with early intervention, the changes into the school district is very drastic. They come out from this nurturing little classroom with the teachers and all these helpers and all these services into a system, like we said, that's under budget, and trying to see to get as much as they can get for their child, to have the services in place. And sometimes because of the situations and the transitions, and because sometimes the child, they think that it's going to a certain school, but then they say it doesn't have what the child needs to meet the needs, so the child has to be transferred to another school. And, you know, the situation with the school bus, if they have the proper seating for the child. So it's like, for a lot of parents, it's very difficult.
Becky, one of the things I'm hearing from you is that parents need information, they need advocacy, but I'm also hearing parents need respite. Is that an option for parents? Is it out there? And how can they get
it? Yes, there is. There is out there. And that's we try, when we receive a call from a family, we assess the whole situation. Sometimes when the parent calls us, they're very frustrated of one situation. But when you sit down and you speak to them, there's other things that are frustrating them too. It's not only, you know, the problem with the child or the school system. There's a bunch of other little situations around that. And we always see the family as a whole, because everything affects the child, and the same opposite, it affects the family. So we try, even though it's not in our description to do this, but we try to do the whole family. Like if they need any other kind of services, we'll look for those services. We'll do research for those services, and we will tell the parent, this is the place that you can call. They'll probably be able to help you. If you don't find services there, call us back. We'll try to find something else for you.
That's the voice of Becky Espanol of the Parents Involved Network. We're listening to excerpts from a panel discussion on special education taped here at WHYY. Our guests were Dr. Herman Axelrod, he's the executive director of the Green Tree School in Philadelphia, Dr. Linda Grobman, superintendent of the Radnor Township School District, and Dr. Leslie Neighbors-Ola. She's a senior researcher at the Consortium for Policy Research in Education at the Penn Graduate School of Education. We'll be back after a short break. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY.
Pennsylvania Ballet supports WHYY and presents La Sylphie with Barber Violin Concerto at the Academy of Music June 5th through the 13th. A season finale of masterworks, this program features Barber Violin Concerto and La Sylphie, a tale of love last performed by Pennsylvania Ballet 21 years ago. For tickets, 215-893-1999 or online at paballet.org.
Benjamin Lovell Shoes supports WHYY, featuring shoes from Dansko, Merrill, Mephisto, Clarks, and Cole Haan, with locations throughout Philadelphia, Haddonfield, Gleneagles Square, and Baltimore. Benjamin Lovell Shoes. Style never felt so good.
Welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Mike and Scott. We're listening to excerpts from a recent panel discussion on special education that Dan Gottlieb and I hosted together here at WHYY. Our guests were Dr. Herman Axelrod, he is the executive director of the Green Tree School in Philadelphia, Dr. Linda Grobman, superintendent for the Radnor Township School District, and Dr. Leslie Neighbors-Ola of the Penn Graduate School of Education. We were taking questions from the audience.
Hi, I worked in Inclusion Shangri-La for a number of years and then took some time off and came here tonight exactly to find out what Dan said earlier was, does inclusion work and who does it work for? I wanted to know what had happened in the time that I wasn't involved in the system anymore. And I'm almost giddy with the level of discussion that I've heard here tonight. But my one question is, as far as support in the classroom, at the classroom level, from early intervention, the honeymoon that exists, to the transition, I just wonder where each of you sees the level of support for the classroom teacher, which is how I was involved. So each of you, or any of you who feels that they have something, I'm just interested in the level of support that exists now. So thank you.
Linda?
I think Leslie touched on this a little earlier when she talked about pre-service I know many of our universities are now deeply immersed with our school districts to provide additional training for teachers, both those that are special education certified and those that are not. And in fact, I'm aware of several universities that are looking at teachers that are certified in a subject area, if you will, a math teacher, and then providing them training for special education. So our universities have been wonderful partners. School districts have been dedicating lots of dollars and hours to professional development to ensure that everyone is brought up to speed with the best practices, the state of the art. So we're emerging and growing, I believe.
Some school districts are new at the game of educating children with special needs, and we have an arm of Green Tree called Green Tree Partnerships, where we go out to school districts and work with the staff and staff development. We'll go into classrooms and work with the teachers there. We will set up behavior plans for entire classrooms or schools or for individual children and observing them. And I think that the inclusion teacher with the special educator in the classroom still needs some help because of the extraordinary needs of the special children in the classroom as well as the diversity of the regular children in the classroom.
And also I would just add to that is perhaps we need to rethink a bit the role of both the, we've talked about the regular education teacher needing to know about the various needs of children in the classroom, but also the traditional role of the special ed teacher has been to work directly with students. And now I think we need to look at one of the roles of the special ed teacher is to be a consultant and a resource for the school.
We also have in the audience Cecilia Thompson. She is the chairperson for the Philadelphia Right to Education Local Task Force. Cecilia, thank you so much for being here. Tell us a little bit about the kind of work you do.
Basically, our function is to look at systemic issues within the school district for public and charter schools and bring those to the attention of the school district and say, this is what's going on with a group of individuals. This is an issue that we need to rectify because this issue is a barrier that's preventing a group of students from getting a free and appropriate public education.
Give us an example.
I was just going to say that.
For example, one of the issues we're working on is extended school year. Now, the law says recoupment and regression issues qualify somebody for extended school year. What's happening is those students who are considered high incidence or very high functioning still aren't getting those services. If a family pushes for those services, they are put in summer school and the supports do not follow them, and that's not acceptable. If somebody is in ninth grade but they're functioning on a fifth grade level, they have a regression and recoupment issue, but because they may be able to have reciprocal conversation, they can function, and their particular exceptionality is not as prevalent as those with severe disabilities, it is an assumption that they do not need those extra services in the summer. And we're currently working with the School District of Philadelphia to try and rectify that, to get the programs to change the mindset of the teachers so that when they turn 18 or 21, they can get a job, not be on the system, and function and have a quality of life that we all want for our children.
It sounds to me like from everything we've heard tonight that, you know, we say the squeaky wheel gets the grease. And those kids who may not be doing as well seem to get more attention because their behavior calls that attention to them. And those children who have parents who are there advocating for them and who have other people involved seem to get more attention. But if a child does relatively well and is relatively quiet in the classroom and nobody asks any questions, it seems like those kids would fly under the radar then and not get services that they may need.
And that's true, but then that's the job of, you know, our organization, Parent Involved Networks, and the other various organizations. We need to educate the parents on their rights. You are entitled to these services. For example, my son, he thinks in pictures. He's on the autistic spectrum, and he thinks in pictures. We get on YouTube. We're drawing stuff. So what the IEP team decided was to get the books for English language learners, because most of those books are in pictures so that they can help them translate from whatever language their primary language to the English language. And the team agreed, and those are the books that we're using that are on his grade level. So you really have to kind of think outside the box. And if you have a teacher and a principal that's willing to work with you, and really that's the key, a principal that's willing to work, you know, with the whole school, then you produce children who are, you know, who have a quality education and are productive in society. So it really takes a team effort. But again, Philadelphia is really large, and we just have to do a better job in educating the parents and convincing them to advocate, you know, for their children so that they get the supports and services they need.
As I listen to your services and your question about parents who are not the squeaky wheel and a child who is quiet, educationally disabled and failing, what happens there? It sounds like parents need more than information. They need people who will fight for them and fight with them. So I wonder if, say, for example, an IEP, are there people who will go into the room with you?
Yes, the Parents Involved Network will send a one-on-one advocate, and actually we did take advantage of that at one point. And, you know, her job was to back us up, and that was extremely helpful.
IEP meetings have become somewhat litigious, and they have been since the inception of IDEA, and parents get lawyers to represent them in IEP meetings. If there's an impasse between the school and the parents, they can go to a due process hearing where there's a hearing master who determines what is appropriate, and then the child is entitled to that.
I don't want to lose the fact that in many schools there are teachers, therapists, and principals that take on that parental role and go out and advocate for students. So it is in some cases where you have a household where there are two parents and they are committed to their child and are able to do that, that's great and that's wonderful. But some of our children come to school without those supports. And so the school has taken up and will go to that IEP and help advocate for that child.
And that does need to be said, yes. Because schools' hearts are almost always in the right place. Yes. And when my daughter Debbie brought Sam to public school in Maryland, they had a meeting with the principal and a couple of the teachers, and they said, let's not do this IEP quite yet. We know about Sam. Let's just watch him for a little while, and then we'll all figure out what he needs. Then we'll have the IEP.
Let's take another question from the audience. We're going to go over there.
My name is Cynthia Garrett Artis. I'm also an employee at Parents Involved Network. My question is, what about the parents as they speak in minority that don't know their rights, that don't understand their child's disability, and have become frustrated? I work with parents every day who I go into the school board where you have a child that's in total crisis, and it brings the family in a crisis, and they don't know where to turn. And because of, again, financial situations and budgeting issues in the school system, that child or that parent becomes stigmatized as a problem child or a problem family, and they don't have the support of the school. When you talk about IEP, individual education plan, what happens when you have a parent sitting there who can't read or write, and you trying to educate her child who can't read or write, and she's frustrated and asking for help, that because we're not funded or doesn't have enough money to give her the extra support, her child is just pushed along into the inclusion class, into the push and pull. I, too, am a mother of children with disability. And notice I said children because I'm a foster parent of 16 years who children come into the home with many disabilities where we have to go out and advocate for a child's service. I go into the meetings. When I go in with a parent, I always have my parent sit at the front of the table because I need a parent to know you are the most important person in this meeting. You need to be able to navigate
what happens to your child with any kind of disability. And it is very important to me as a parent that I understand what is written in the IEP. But how can I understand as a parent if you have staff sitting around the table that don't understand what's in the IEP? I have been in meetings where I had to actually scratch out, tear up, redo an IEP for the school system because they have what is known as the easy IEP, where you just click, 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 click. Every child is not a click. And I even had a teacher tell me, oh, I only can write but so much in that box. No, you can type as much as you want if you type it. So therefore, my thing is we need to change it so that these children can get what he or she needs in the school district. I need to just share this one short story. I have a child that had disability in the school. And when you talk about transitioning from zero into them teen years, yes, it might be that child that sits in the back of the room pretty quiet in a special environment that he or she is not being paid attention to because they're quiet. I have a child that was on drugs. In the classroom, the teacher sent this child to the library to sleep the high off for 3 weeks and never informed me as a parent, but also never informed anybody within the school because this is the level of care. It's big. She said, I got 36 other students. Why should I have called anybody? He was asleep. But you're talking about a child that has special needs. If he's using mind-altering chemicals, what if that chemical told him, okay, I'm in this library, let me jump out that window? Who was there to supervise this child with special needs? How come a counselor wasn't informed? How come a nurse wasn't informed? How come the parent was not informed until they came to an IEP about his education to be told that your child is going through all
these,
this?
These questions obviously are critical, and
yes,
they demand answers, I'm sure, most of which are not going to be forthcoming from this platform tonight. I just have one question back to you, mm-hmm, and it comes back to your original comments. The problem child, the crisis in school, who becomes a crisis in the family. How does that family, that child, get from that moment to the Parents Involved Network?
What I tell parents is, because we only have one criteria to get the service, the parent must call us.
How do they find
out
about it?
So what I tell people in the schools, we take pamphlets and literature everywhere we go. We run support groups all over the city. I tell friends tell family. I go to agencies. I might be in a corner store and put a pile of pamphlets down for parents, but if they don't know to call or to come, they won't ever get there.
Right.
So it's our job as employees, it's our job as the professionals to get us out there to,
yes,
be able to deal with the crisis that's going on within the school system.
Thank you so much for what you've brought up. It's terribly important for all of us to be aware of it.
Let's take one more question from the audience.
So what works, Mikan? I'm Bruce Haynes. I'm the parent of a 19-year-old college freshman who spent most of his life working very hard to learn how to work with his strengths to work around his dyslexia. But where in the country, either by policy or implementation or the models that do work? I hear every day about school boards being taken to task and being ordered to provide by judges compensatory education. And I'm happy for those families because I think they deserve that education. But as a taxpayer, that's probably not the most efficient way for our school districts to be dispensing those dollars. So where do we look for a model that works better than this highly adversarial one? We're helping today teach parents how to navigate the adversarial system. But is there anything else that we should be bringing to the attention of our legislators that would be more productive?
And maybe also let me ask you, do schools communicate with each other about what works? Do people come to you and say, how do you do it, Herman? What works in your school?
They do, and we have an alliance of our approved private schools. In fact, Nan Porter from the Martin Luther School is sitting in the audience, and she is the president of the State Alliance. and goes to Harrisburg frequently, and we have monthly meetings where we talk about legislation, best practices. I'm not sure that answers your question about what school districts can do and what schools can do to meet the needs of children who have some specialized kinds of disabilities, but I think it comes back to the administration within the school, the teachers within the school, and the supports all of them give each other. And in that sense, it can work. And there are certain schools and certain districts where it's magnificent, and in other schools, it's a dismal failure. And I think parents have to shop around for the right place as well.
Well, I've sat here tonight and tried to be a good student and learn what I can learn. And I'll tell you some of the things I've learned tonight. I've learned that there is litigation available, and I also know that litigation clarifies legislation and often drives new legislation. I've also learned that the whole world of special needs needs more money, much more money for research, because we're way lacking in what we need to know. School districts need much more money to do the jobs they need to do. I've also learned that teachers need more education and they need time, just like parents need more time and they need more respite and they need more services. But the thing, the message I got, I think you began it, Leslie, and I heard it from several parents, the message is, what we need overall, from our legislators and politicians to our school districts to our neighbors, is we need understanding. We need a community that'll look at a kid with special needs and see a kid first and make accommodations from that point on. I want to thank all three of you. Thank you, Mikan, for this wonderful evening and for your wonderful information. And a special thanks to the audience for coming out.
You've been listening to excerpts from a panel discussion on special education. Our guests were Dr. Linda Grobman, superintendent of the Radnor Township School District, Dr. Leslie Neighbors-Ola of the Penn Graduate School of Education, and Dr. Herman Axelrod, executive director of the Greentree School in Philadelphia. The discussion was moderated by Dr. Dan Gottlieb, host of Voices in the Family, and WHYY's behavioral health reporter, Mike and Scott. It was part of our In the Spirit of Family series presented by WHYY's Children's Service. The engineers for today's show were Al Banks, John Knapp, and Bob Perdick. This program was made possible in part by support from the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation and the Early Childhood and Special Education Department at Westchester University. Special thanks to Susan Palenko and Jennifer Wheeler of WHYY's Children's Service. You can listen to this program and other programs on our website, whyy.org.